Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill.
Even the old folks in Devon knew.
He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harris? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yep.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired!
North Carolina General Assembly enacted.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the bowels of the North Carolina legislature, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along. A Friday in October, and yes, they are still in session. That means it's time to review some of what happened this week in North Carolina politics. Here for the discussion are Billy Ball from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More mini budgets. It has now been just about 4 months since the governor vetoed the legislature spending plan. So without a new budget, state lawmakers continued their piecemeal approach of funding various governmental needs. This week saw the advancement of bills that would provide bonuses for public school principals, step increases for teachers, raises for UNC and community college workers, as well as some tax provisions that did advance, fate to be determined. What was the most notable fiscal development from this week, Becky?
From this week? Fiscal development, the conversation about the franchise tax and the film credits, I thought was an interesting debate. Again, you know, we've heard deja vu all over again. We heard this discussion as the budget was being put together, as the tax packages were being put together. If it's a good idea to lower taxes for businesses, to attract businesses to come, and what that means economically for the state. On the other hand, then they're also talking about giving away, not really giving away additional money, but extending the tax credits for the film industry. So as far as fiscal news and the impact that it have, I would say that has been kind of the interest this week.
I would say, you know, from the other side here, I don't think that this week was so much about what has happened, but yet again about what hasn't happened. If you're sitting there in a classroom and you're still waiting on the raises that you've been promised, or you're waiting on the support staff that you've been promised, then this week's action feels like a whole lot of inaction, a lot of talking and passing blame back and forth. So as far as the mini budgets go, I can see how they happen. I could see how it's one sort of roundabout way to deal with this clash between the governor and the legislature. But it's not really getting things done as far as our public school system and advancing the many, many issues that are before them.
I think the most significant thing that happened this week with these mini budgets, to be honest with you, was when we started this several weeks ago as an alternative around the override of the veto, of to put some of these things in effect. And it was agreement from the very beginning. These would be provisions that there was wide agreement on, some things that needed to be done, things like funding enrollment in the schools. I mean, you know, we're still going to have the additional kids showing up to the ADM numbers, that formula, some things like that. And from the very beginning, it was, we're going to tackle the things that have wide agreement and immediate need that we all agree on. And so we're going to do this in a series of these mini budgets. The thing that has been significant this week to me is it feels like they have hit a brick wall with that. The two big mini budgets that we've seen this week are the ones about the franchise tax and the film credit. And again, I just thought the economic discussion again was interesting, but there was a lot of disagreement with it and a lot of pushback with it. And the vote on that in the Senate on that particular one, I think I have to go back and double check, but it was, if it wasn't clearly along party lines, it was awfully close to clearly along party lines. We saw a mini budget that talked about cybersecurity and funding that at a private school, and there was a tremendous amount of controversy. The debate during that really got very testy. To me, it feels like we've moved past that threshold or that line, if you will, of where the mini budgets are that everybody can agree on and we're just going to get this done because we all believe it's important to get that into place. We're kind of past that. It was really my takeaway from the mini budget discussions this week.
And we're at a place also that the collective mini budgets, really, it's not even a significant portion of the full budget. And I think that's just perhaps worth noting. You can address it if you want, but you know, the full budget was about $24 billion. As of the beginning of this week, there had been maybe $1.1, $1.2 billion aggregate that had been moved through in these mini budgets. So we're talking about a relatively small number. And that's according just to some of the correspondence that I've had with lawmakers. If these bills move forward, these latest pay raises we're talking about, it's still less than 20% of that big overall state budget that was vetoed back in June. So just a little bit of financial context, so to speak, because what we're still talking about is a slice, if not a sliver, of what was approved. Go ahead, Billy.
And I think that's a good point to make to provide that context. But one of the issues, and I've said this before, one of the issues with these mini budgets is we see the logic in debating the things that are non-controversial and moving those forward. We see that. But at a certain point when we're talking about Christmas advertising starting to appear on television and we're talking about a few weeks and planning out our Thanksgiving vacations, at some point we have to say, when are we going to talk about the things that are really dividing mostly politicians, not so much North Carolinians. North Carolinians, the majority of them agree on Medicaid expansion, and they agree on the value in supporting our public schools fully. These are obviously the big conflicts between the governor and the legislature. So it seems as if these mini budgets have just been a way to work around actually trying to resolve those issues.
A news note and a historical note, and then we'll move on. But the news note is that Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick, who is from Durham County, his confirmation process to the board of the Utility Commission began on Thursday. And if he is gone from the Senate come next Tuesday or Wednesday, it makes a veto override vote all the more manageable. If he is gone, Republicans would need either a Democratic senator to vote with the majority party or a Democratic senator to, quote unquote, take a walk, as we say around here. So I just offer that as a reminder that there is still this $24 billion budget. The House did manage to get the override vote through, and it could, in theory, I'm not offering any prediction here, but in theory, it could move through the Senate in an override next week, which would settle this whole budget conversation. The other thing, and Becky, you can jump in here, but the other thing, the historical note I was going to mention before I forget, is now, as we turn our attention to ham and wreaths, it is the longest session we've had in 18 years, longest legislative session since 2001.
Feels like
I was here in 2001, and I remember we went into December. It was the first or second. My birthday is December 14th, and I think we went home right before my birthday, which was the best birthday present ever. I'd like an early birthday present this year. But it has dragged on and on. It's been a difficult session. You know, there's a lot of things that have just really been hard. This budget, I think, is the best example of that. You know, and as you mentioned, this override vote, the vote is much closer in the Senate, and if they can make that happen, then the budget goes into place. And I think then some of these other things that they're dealing with, they wrap that up very quickly.
Let's talk about Medicaid, not expansion, rather the people already in North Carolina on the rolls of this federal health care program. There are about 2 million of those people, and there has been a plan to change how care is administered. However, without a budget, there is no funding. Lawmakers previously sent the governor a mini budget to fund Medicaid transformation, but Governor Cooper vetoed it. This week, Governor Cooper's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mandy Cohen, said that a new budget is very much needed to implement the transformation and also to retain quality staff. In an interesting twist, I think we should note that the mini budget that the governor did veto on this did have the backing of Secretary Cohen, so kind of going this way and that way. Billy, any optimism that these two sides, legislature and the governor, can manage to figure this thing, Medicaid transformation, out?
I think we'll have to, considering the stance that the governor's office has taken so far, it seems as if they need to at least be at the table talking about Medicaid expansion. I know that this issue is about – it isn't about Medicaid expansion, but we're talking about the transition to managed care benefits. That's really hung up here, and I hope that the listening public can distinguish between the two. One of the things that the governor has tried to say here is that we need to address these issues together. And as I mentioned before, with the conversations around these mini budgets, it often just seems as if we're avoiding talking about the big issues or the big conflicts between the legislature and the governor right now. It seems like this is one of them. I'm not filled with a whole lot of optimism, to be honest, that unless we see two parties at the table who are talking about Medicaid in total, that we're going to see the governor moving on this. Of course, I'm not in his office, so who knows?
Well, I'm not either, so we don't know. But, you know, I think Billy's absolutely right, and the two things are connected. And I would connect them, though, perhaps in a little bit different way, in that we already have this Medicaid transformation affects 1.6 million low-income North Carolinians. And this delay on this rollout of changing the way that they receive their health care under Medicaid is very complicated. It's very complex. The original plan was to do it in stages because there's so many people that are going to be impacted by this. And everything from the technology that comes around it to making sure that doctors and hospitals and contracts are in place, this very compressed time frame that we're under now, even some of the discussion at the General Assembly this week was we're already past the point with the time frame of being able to implement this effectively. My concern is that we have this problem and we have other problems within our Medicaid system for our current Medicaid enrollees. And I would like to see all of this fixed and straightened out and the managed care implemented and implemented successfully before we put another 643,000 individuals onto a Medicaid program. So I agree with Billy. The two things are related. I might relate them in a little bit different way. But any way that you look at this, particularly with this Medicaid transformation, and the testimony that we heard this week from Secretary Mandy Cohen, I think just drove this home, is this is a real problem. And, you know, again, 1.6 million North Carolinians depend on their health care through this. So I'm not sure how we're going to resolve this. But I guess part of one of the solutions would be you just delay moving onto this managed care system for some determined amount of time until you can make sure that you do it right.
And my loose understanding is if that happens, if that gets moved back to next July or even later, that is going to bear out a cost. That's going to be even more
right.
expensive for the state.
So yes. And already, I think issue, it's, I mean, those contracts mm-hmm. are worth $6 billion, I think I've heard
sounds
that
right,
reported.
Not in front of me, but yeah.
And then, you know, just today there's a report in Carolina Journal about the contracts and Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield and the different managed care companies that would be managed this. You know, we even have controversy about who got that contract. It is just a mess.
The newest member of the UNC Board of Governors is Reginald Holley. His appointment makes the board whole again with 24 members. One-fourth of that board are registered lobbyists. Are you okay with this many lobbyists serving on the UNC Board of Governors? Should there be a limit as to how many could serve or a ban altogether?
Absolutely not. I'm not okay with that many lobbyists serving on there. We're talking about six current or former lobbyists that are sitting on that board. And it, at some point, you have to ask whether access to power is a qualification. Because when we see members appointed like this who have business that they're working on currently before the legislature, where there's a relationship between the lawmakers who oversee the Board of Governors, who appoint these members, and the private work that these lobbyists are doing to get their causes before the legislature, obviously there are conflicts of interest. And, you know, not probably a technical conflict of interest as far as the law goes, but I think people's perceptions of a conflict of interest are much broader than the law usually. So, yes, I think it's an issue, and I think it's only going to complicate the way people view the Board of Governors and whether they believe that they can do a credible job leading the UNC system.
I'm not as concerned about the number of lobbyists. What I'm concerned about, and Billy, this really goes to your point too, is what do they do, and in their role as a lobbyist, are there conflicts of interest with their role as a member of the Board of Governor? That would be my concern. I would, instead of trying to limit the number or putting some kind of restrictions on that, you know, as Billy alluded to, maybe we need to look at the conflict of interest regulations and the rules around there and change that a little bit. On the other hand, you know, let me just say, you know, for this is assuming that there are not conflicts of interest or any kind of efforts for personal gain or anything like that. I mean, this is that not that at all. But members of the Board of Governors lobby for, they advocate and represent all the different universities. So on the one hand, to have lobbyists who know how to do that and lobby for those universities, I don't think that skill set or that profession should be eliminated. In some ways, I think that it might be really helpful to have bring those skill sets to the Board of Governors. But again, you know, as Billy alluded to and Jeff, you did too, it's the conflict of interest that I think we all should be concerned about, whether you're a lobbyist or whether you're a business person or whether you're an academic serving on the Board of Governors. I think the conflict of interest is the question.
Mm-hmm. And to me, it's not so much whether the lobbying work has direct relationship to what the UNC Board of Governors is overseeing. Obviously, that's an issue too. But at the core of a lobbyist's work is having the favor of a legislator. When you're looking at a situation in which people on the Board of Governors need the support and favoritism of a legislator, you have to start asking, when are they taking orders from the legislature, and when are they acting as a member of the Board of Governors to do what's best for the system? So to me, the whole setup to have a lobbyist on there is a problem.
I think we need to be really careful, you know, in when we begin eliminating any kind of profession, whether it's to serve as an elected official or whether it's to serve on a board or commission. You know, we want more good people to step up and fill these roles. And I think when you start putting more prohibitions on that, I just think it's a dangerous way to go, something to really be thoughtful about.
One final topic. On Thursday, redistricting reform received a committee hearing. There were three bills that were up for discussion only. Now, state lawmakers have redrawn election lines here since the beginning of time, or at least the beginning of North Carolina. Three different bills that do not appear imminent for movement or votes or anything like that. Was this anything more than kind of a symbolic moment, a symbolic hour or two of discussion? I realize, let me give a little more context here. There was a redistricting bill, Independent Redistricting Commission bill, that actually was approved by a Republican-led North Carolina House in 2011, and then it died in the Senate. So this is not unprecedented territory. But we had another debate on Thursday. Is it anything more than a nice symbolic moment?
Well, I want to hope that it is. My organization and I have been a big advocate for redistricting reform for all the years that we've been involved in this. I think that now is the perfect time to really take a look at this. In the middle of all of these redistricting cases and the acrimony and just having come off of two very intense weeks of legislators redrawing districts, I think now is the perfect time to really address this. So I'm hoping that they will. And at this committee, Representative David Lewis, the chairman of the committee, made a comment about he wasn't sure that there was a bill that was ready to be addressed by the end of the month. And, of course, I'm paraphrasing here. But, you know, that gave me some hope that, okay, at least we're looking at some kind of time frame here. At the end of the meeting, he also kind of set up, here are some takeaways from the meeting. Here are some questions that we want to continue to look at. Things like groupings, what does that mean? When you say drawing maps in public, what are you talking about? What are communities of interest? When you have these rules and criteria, is there a hierarchy with it? So the comments at the end of the meeting indicated that this conversation this week in the General Assembly was just the beginning and that we would see more of it. I would love to see them pass real redistricting reform before they leave, even if that is in the next week or so. I'm not terribly optimistic about that, but I think now is the time to do it. I wrote a Carolina Journal column last week on this very issue, that now is the time to do this.
You know, I kind of come at this from the perspective of a career reporter, and I think members of the public will sympathize with this feeling as well. I don't so much pay attention to what legislators or politicians say, but pay a lot more attention to what they do. I think in the moment that we see something move, then I think we can believe that the legislature is serious about this. And obviously, there's a great deal more pressure on them now to actually move, with the courts being as stringent as they are. The courts have sent a message that we cannot rest and assume that the legislature is going to do the right thing. And you know, I think Becky will agree with me on this. This is not a Democrat or a Republican issue. If you talk to the voters, this is a nonpartisan correction that needs to be made. It's been an issue in this country and in this state for many, many years. And at this point, there's been no motivation for the folks who are in power to take some sort of action unless it benefits them down the road. So, you know, members of the public would be fair in seeing it this way, that the legislators are not ignorant of their demands. They're indifferent to them so far. And we're hoping that this pressure that's being applied by the courts, whether it's on the congressional maps, whether it's on the state legislative maps, are going to see some sort of way to advance a notion that limits, hopefully, the legislature's power as much as possible in setting these maps. I know one of the three limits that farther than the others. It doesn't seem like it's going to move as much in the legislature.
Well, and a lot, let me just add, if I could, that a lot of the discussion that we've heard this year and previous years, too, is who is going to draw the maps. And you'll hear people say, you know, we don't want the legislature to do it. We want someone else to do it. Or that seems to be one of the questions
but
that people are asking.
And how many? And well, how are they chosen?
Exactly. But here's really, I think, the question that we should ask is, what are the rules around this? And if we have a really strict set of rules that there's very little wiggle room, then it doesn't matter so much who draws the maps as to do we adhere to the rules that are in place. So if we can all agree to what the rules are, and I think that we've seen that develop. One of the bills, I think it's House Bill 140, has a list of criteria that the voters, the people, would be asked to enshrine in the Constitution that is not the process, it's the rules that are in place, and then leave it up to the General Assembly to decide who then would take those rules and draw those maps. But I just wanted to kind of put that out there,
that
as we talk about this, I think that just focusing on who's going to draw the maps doesn't really get to the root of the problem in my mind. It's what are the rules that are going to be in place, and how can we put those, how can we restrict whoever's going to draw the map to what those rules are that we've agreed to.
And I'm not trying to be smart aleck, but I would respond with the questions of who decides those rules, who enforces those rules, how often do those rules, if ever, get reviewed or adjusted?
Or do they need to be adjusted periodically? And in answer to your question, we have seen in the Stevenson case, there were criteria that were laid out. In some of these later cases that we've seen, the courts have embraced those Stevenson criteria. So I think it has developed through litigation and through courts. And so with all this endless litigation that we've had for decades, if we can say, well, okay, there is some good that's come out of that, other than just making everybody mad at each other, it's that we've developed this set of rules and criteria through the courts. This isn't something that, you know, we're going to put that out and a legislative committee is going to come up with it tomorrow. And this is something that's developed over time through the courts, but with legislative input and also public input through all of this.
Billy Ball is managing editor at NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray, senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekends.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Get on with the show.
As a radio reminder, you can hear a broadcast version of this conversation each Friday at 4:50 on 91.5 FM throughout the Triangle. Thanks for spending some time in the WUNC Politics Podcast feed. Remember, it's a bi-weekly drop now. Long-form conversations will appear earlier in the week. Then, on Fridays, we'll drop this conversation. I call it WISP, Week in State Politics, which is usually with Becky and Rob. Remember to give us a rating and review. I'm told that helps grow the audience. And if there are topics that need more addressing, please let me know. I'm on Twitter at J_Tibbs.